Sunday, July 6, 2008, upon further review, episode number 60. Now, we know we've been gone for a while, but occasionally other aspects of life simply get in the way. But to make it up to you, we've decided to review not three, but four things in this episode. Four for the price of three. One way or the other, we promise to get you the reviews you crave. Okay, upon further review, I'm Greg.
I'm Clea.
And we are pleased to welcome, yet again, our guest star, Russ. I don't know if this is the third show you've done with us or a fourth show, but anyway, welcome, Russ, once again to UFR.
It is me. Yay!
It is an eating Russ.
It's an eating Russ.
Clicking his dishes.
That's right.
Almost done.
Okay, it's fine. It's all right. Take your time.
That's right.
It's all right.
So we want to welcome everybody back, and I think Clea and I are titling this the We're Sorry We've Been Gone show, because we have been gone for about a month, and we've been out in Seattle, we've been traveling around, and as all of you know, we have a baby, and so that has all been depressing our schedule.
Are we going to blame it on the baby, like, for the next 18 years?
At least. Okay. When she reaches her 40s, and like, do you remember when you kept us from doing our show when you were 5 months? And she'll be appropriately upset. But anyway, so we want to thank everybody for continuing to tune in and send us comments. Chris actually sent us some suggestions for review, and other people stopped by and had some nice things to say, and so we always appreciate that, of course.
We should put up another picture so they can see how cute she is.
I know. She is cute. And eventually, someone is saying, you know, that we actually have to do a real review of her, but I don't know what to say. I mean, we gave her a 10 at the beginning, so what happens if she drops, you know, and we get like a 9, and then she thinks about that.
That is really delicate territory right there.
I know.
I mean, that's like, we're pretty much deciding her future therapy bill right there.
Right, which I think is a dangerous
How
thing.
How do you rate the human being?
Especially when it's your daughter that you're rating. Exactly.
So one that you made.
Exactly. I know. What does it say about us? Seriously. But we want to thank everyone for being out there and still listening. And so, by way of apology, we're actually going to be reviewing not three things, but four things tonight. The fourth thing is a mystery for our guest, because it's a topic that I think he'll have a lot to say about. And the other three items are going to be one that's something that's very topical, I think. And the other two are podcasts. Normally, we do not review more than one podcast a show, and we are not just a podcast review show, as you people know.
Yes.
But we did want to try to catch up a little bit on our backlog, and so many nice people have said, can you review us, that we wanted to try to catch up a little bit. So we're going to be viewing four items total and two podcasts tonight. So we're going to get started by reviewing the only non-podcast item that's up there, and that's going to be Wimbledon. Wimbledon, the tennis championships, just concluded today. We're recording this on July 6th, and they just concluded today with what many people are calling the best tennis match ever played between Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal. So I thought it would be an appropriate time to talk about Wimbledon. So we're going to start by reviewing that. Then we're going to move on to review the two podcasts. Normally we end with a podcast, but we're going to review the two podcasts so we can save the mystery for Russ for the very end. So the two podcasts we're going to review are the Kunstler Cast, that's K-U-N-S-T-L-E-R Cast, which is kind of an interview talk show with James Howard Kunstler, and we'll talk a little bit about that when we get there. And then the second show is the Volcanicast, which is kind of a broad-based, semi-comedy, semi-talk show type of podcast, which we'll talk about when we get to that point. And then we're going to conclude with the mystery topic, which we will talk about when we get there, so Russ doesn't know it until then. And so that's what we're going to do.
Yep.
So we're going to start by talking about Wimbledon. And you can find information about Wimbledon at www.wimbledon.org. For those of you who don't know, this is one of the four so-called Grand Slam tennis championships, four in a year. The Australian Open, the French Open, Wimbledon, and then the U.S. Open, which takes place in late August, early September.
Mm-hmm. And we've reviewed the U.S. Open.
And I think it's also the oldest of them as well. It's also the only one which is played on the grass surface as opposed to hard court or clay, mm-hmm, or some of these other interior hybrid surfaces. This is a grass surface, and so tennis tends to be very fast on that surface. It tends to be something where, you know, big servers often get favored and things like that. And it has produced a lot of memorable matches over the years, but none more memorable than the men's final today, which was really, really tremendous. I had a chance to see the majority of it, and it was a great match. Nadal finally won at Wimbledon, knocking off Federer, who had won the last five championships. And so it was a very impressive match. John McEnroe, who was calling it, said it was the best tennis match that he's ever seen, which which is, I think, you know, I think John McEnroe will know more about it than I will, certainly. So so I would take his word at it. So.
Yeah,
so
I saw the first part of it and then put her down for a nap, fell asleep, and then wake up to Greg saying, oh, yeah, you just missed the best tennis match of all time.
And Cleo said, thank you. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot. But that's basically the idea. It's been around for over 100 years, at least, I think, in some form or another. And for a long time, it was considered kind of, it's been always held at the All England Club in London. And
so it's supposedly
been
quite pretty.
It's quite pretty, and it's always been held with sort of very traditional attire. Players always wear white. They used to use for many years white tennis balls as sort of a part of that, and they never had a roof. They're actually going to finally have a retractable roof next year, which is a big deal for the All England Club because, well, it's the All England Club.
And it's in England, and they have rain.
And they have rain, so it makes sense. And so it was actually, the club itself was started in 1877, and the ladies' single championship started in 1884, and it says from a field of 13 players, and that's changed. Actually, it hasn't changed because there's still basically about 13 good players. No, I'm just kidding.
Just going back to what you're talking about, is there a dress code for people in the audience? Because it seems like people...
Oh, I think it's like the Kentucky Derby type of thing. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to wear reasonably nice clothes, even though I imagine some people don't.
And then the other tradition is the strawberries
and cream
in a blue bowl.
That's right. And also, Henman Hill, which is where people used to watch Tin Henman, who was a British player, play, because the British have not won a championship, their own championship there, for, I don't know, something like 50 years. So they keep waiting for someone from Great Britain to win their championship, and it's all part of restoring empire and all that sort of thing. But,
so, I mean, I highly recommend watching it next year if you haven't, simply because, as Greg said, you know, with the way that the court is, you do get to see some nice quick matches, some pretty good tennis. But one thing I have to say is that the last couple of years, I was noticing how the grass gets worn down because it's actual grass by people going over certain areas. And one interesting thing is you can kind of see how the game of tennis changes over the years by where the grass gets worn down.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But one thing that I noticed this year is I watched Venus's first match.
Venus Williams, who won the championship this year on the women's side.
And the grass was already worn down by then. And I kind of have an issue with that because it means that, like, the majority of places where they're running and the majority of places where the ball is landing, it's not landing on grass, it's landing on dirt.
They actually had a picture of a guy who was sweeping dirt as if you were at, you know, like Fenway Park Stadium or something, sweeping the dirt, and you're kind of like...
So I wonder if anyone's complaining. I mean, I think that's a problem because that's changing the type of... the ground that they're playing on.
Yeah, it certainly affects the surface. I think it's not quite as fast as it used to be back in the day. And Clea's quite right. You know, if you used to watch it back in the mid-80s, you would see a bunch of... the grass would be worn from, like, the baseline to the net because that's people were running up and serving and volleying. Now it's all sort of running back and forth along the baseline. And then every so often you find this one obscure patch which seems to be bare and you're never really clear why. You know, does the umpire, you know, hang out there between matches and so
it's
it gradually
gremlins.
Gets worn away? Is it gremlins? Like, what, you know?
Yeah, it's little gremlins.
Is that an entrance into the world of Harry Potter? You know, what is it that's happening? But
Russ, do you have anything to say on Wimbledon?
I want to set up Russ for this, though, because Russ is kind of a natural... I wouldn't say Russ is a natural tennis fan specifically, so I wanted to get his perspective as a big sports fan, but not necessarily a tennis fan, about his take on things like Wimbledon, say.
Yeah, my ethnocentric inclinations lead me to be bored by popular tennis right now because I don't think there's a particularly charismatic... big-time star. I think Roger Federer is like the anti-charisma star. And that's why that despite the fact that he's had these ridiculously prolific successes, nobody really cares about him because...
But Nadal now, man.
Kind of, no, it's true.
Nadal, yeah, screams. He's a younger guy. He's got that... But again, he doesn't really speak English, so you can't...
Yeah.
You know, who knows what he's really saying about things. I don't know.
No, it's very true. And to go a little bit along your lines that you're saying, I'll say it so we don't come off sexist. As a woman... the female game is really hurting. It's really annoying. The women are out of shape. They aren't very aggressive.
Clearly,
but anyway, the major issue with female tennis is that they are all head cases.
Yeah, they do have a tendency to melt down.
Every single female character is a head case.
It's true. It's true. And really, you know, the Williams sisters, when they're interested in playing, are very good, but they're really part-time players. Rena would rather design clothing, and that's not making that up. It's true. She's a fashion person. She wants to do that. They're just not interested in playing particularly. And I find the attitude in particular to be irritating. You know, tennis, I think, certainly needs... I agree with Russ that tennis needs charisma. You know, the McEnroe and the Connors of the world, which
well,
really
any
drove
sport
it.
Needs someone.
Needs personality.
Think.
Although I do think that Rafael Nadal has that personality to a degree. But, you know, the Williams sisters... I mean, there they take personality and they add in a lot of arrogance to it. You know, the last year when Justine Henin beat Serena Williams in the semifinals, you know, her reaction to Serena was just this, you know, she talked about Serena Williams and da-da-da, and Serena Williams' reaction to Justine Henin was, well, you know, I made a lot of mistakes and, you know, I can't, you know, it's too bad that I gave her the match. And, you know, just, hello? She's the number one player in the world. I don't think you gave her the match. So we don't particularly care for the attitude, but they're very good here. And I guess the issue is just that, you know, they don't really want to play, and the rest of the women's game is in bad shape. So that was in evidence at Wimbledon, too. It's true. But I don't know, compared to other championships then, Russ, let's put it that way, compared to other, you know, the U.S. Open or these other places, is there anything about the idea of the grass and the history that appeals to you, or are you more like, no, it's not an American thing? So.
No.
Okay.
None whatsoever. No. I mean, I'm not a tennis fan, so I have very little perception of the difference between the various championships anyway.
Right.
What I know of Wimbledon is that they, like, are forced to wear white because they have this draconian dress code, and you're not allowed to do anything or have a personality in any possible way to, you know, be in accord with your British hosts. And that just seems like the most antithetical situation to an exciting sport. Championship that I can think of. It's like, okay, here we are. The World Championships, the most important thing ever. Don't do or say anything. Don't touch anything. It's a museum. And don't have any fun. Oh, that would be a great match.
The game is definitely a lot more quiet than a lot of the other games that I've seen. But Jay-Z was there, Russ.
That's true. Jay-Z was there in the stands.
I don't know if that affects your...
Well, Jay-Z's a member of the, you know, billionaire elite in this world. Like, he's Mr. Corporate Billionaire guy, and that's
so
what
you don't think
he has
that gives...
to do to be a polite in society type of guy.
Oh,
I don't
you
think that would be his activity of choice, really.
I see. Okay.
But you don't think it gives
him
any
to
street
say hi to people at the game.
You don't think it gives him any street cred then?
There's
that
no
he's
street
there.
Cred in tennis. No,
okay.
No such thing.
All right. Well, then, what's
by
your
definition?
Rating?
Anti-street cred. Golf so and tennis, anti-street cred.
I see. So what would you rate Wimbledon?
I mean, I don't know. I didn't even see the match. How am I going to rate what they said the greatest match ever?
I'm not telling you to rate the match. I'm telling you to rate the championship overall.
The Wimbledon over... I didn't see any of it. I give it a null set.
Yeah, okay. So
you've never seen any of it. Okay,
yeah,
well,
so
that was the comment.
We'll move on.
All right, so Clea, what's your rating?
I mean, it does play a role. It plays a historical role in the four championships. So although I really agree with Russ on what the point he's making, I think that the Australian Open, the U.S. Open provide that bit of excitement. 7?
I think that's reasonable. I would probably say a 7 also for the same reason, because I think the French Open, in a way... The Australian Open is a little bit more nondescript, you could say, but the location is interesting. And then the French Open, obviously, you have the clay, and it's kind of these, you know, there are these wars where the match just goes on, and everyone's trying to outlast the other, and it's 150 degrees.
The problem with the French Open is that no one knows anyone who plays, because these weird, obscure people win it.
Well,
but we're not going to rate
now. It's Nadal, you know. But I guess the point is that it's a little bit different.
Right.
Wimbledon used to be more different because of the surface, but as they've become sort of more in line with the other championships, then it does begin to seem as if there's less kind of specific characteristics about it that differentiate it. So, yeah, I think it's reasonable to say a 7. I think my favorite of all the Grand Slams is the U.S. Open, because we've seen it a bunch, and because I think that it's the best combination of surfaces.
Maybe we need to go there and see it. So maybe we should have Wimbledon send us.
Okay. So I think if the Wimbledon championships would like to do that, if they'd like to up their rating from a 7, and
we'll take a ticket.
We reserve the right to up it, and if they don't send us, we reserve the right to lower the rating as well, arbitrarily.
That sounds like blackmail.
No,
very ineffective blackmail, but blackmail nonetheless. Right.
Or in the case of Wimbledon, white male, white clothes. So I'm just pointing that out. White male.
So, all right. So, what's
next? A 7-4 with the Wimbledon championships. Okay. Next on the list is the Kunstler Cast, and you can find this at Kunstler Cast, KUNSTLER Cast, CAST.com.
So I'd like to talk to you about our God-given right to convenience in this country.
Shoot.
Well, do you think that convenience is the God-given right of every American?
No, I think that convenience is a product of a certain set of circumstances that we've been living with for about 50 years.
Yeah.
And it's been interesting, although it has huge diminishing returns, like the giant people I see waddling down the concourse at the Atlanta airport, you know, these these giant hulking human brutes that look like Balloonatherians, you know, with their rolling bags of cheese doodles behind them.
You know, you're the first person, when you busted out with Balloonatherium a couple of shows ago, you're the first person I've ever talked to who knows what a Balloonatherium is. I know.
Well,
what
you
it
know
is.
A lot about a lot of stuff, and that's an interesting thing because you know about things that a lot of people don't. But no, the Balloonatherium is a kind of a funny concept. You know, this land mammal that gets to be the size of an, you know,
it's like 40 feet tall or something.
Size of an RV.
Yeah. Yeah. They're huge.
And by the way, they're not out there anymore.
Yeah.
You know, they're extinct. You know, they arose in Central Asia, I don't know, about, you know, a million years ago, and they had a pretty short run.
Yeah. Megafauna. I mean, I know about this because I was a geeky little kid who used to read dinosaur books and prehistory books and stuff like that.
But what I wonder is, you know, whether God and his various assistants was sitting up there checking this out and you know, watching this and writing on a clipboard and saying, Balloonatherium not working out too well. I think maybe we better scratch this experiment.
Yeah.
I hope they're not saying the same thing about us.
This is actually done by Duncan Crary, who is a co-host of a show that we have previously done, the Humanist News Network. People may remember we reviewed that a few months ago. And Duncan asked us to review it. He actually said to us, and this is back in March, so again, I apologize that it took us a while to get there. But he points out that each week for about 15 minutes, he interviews, talks with James Howard Kunstler, who is, in case you don't know, he's the author of The Geography of Nowhere. He's sort of the leading critic against what he calls suburban sprawl. And actually, he's been interviewed on the Colbert Report and a lot of places like that. So I've actually heard of him before even the show appeared as well. Mm-hmm. So he sent us over and we had a chance to listen to some of the shows and listen to this guy with his take. So
what did you think, Russ?
Yeah, let's start with Russ's take on this show.
I liked what I heard of the one episode that we listened to, which was the most recent posting of the Kunstler cast. Immediately dove into a very unusual conversation topic for this kind of show, which is whether technology is valid in and of itself. And I thought that is exactly what people should be talking about instead of just accepting whatever the newest gadget, the newest release, the iPhone 3.0, you know, wonderful thing.
Yeah.
They were talking about, you know, whether these things are valuable. I think, unfortunately, and I think this was mostly brought on by the co-host, not by Mr. Kunstler, was they could only talk about it in terms of extremes, because on the one hand, they're like, well, these things aren't really valuable, and people with cell phones are idiots, and they talk to their takeout food because you can't see the phone that they're using if they have a Bluetooth. But on the other hand, they're like, you know, I think the Amish people have really got it right, because the Amish people decide for each technological item that they have, you know, whether it's useful or not. I'm like, this is not the solution.
Well, interestingly, though,
is to talk about Amish people.
What was interesting about that, though, is that Kunstler actually, I think Kunstler agreed with you about that, and that Kunstler said that he felt in this episode the Amish fetishized it and that it wasn't really a reasonable evaluation process. So he almost disagreed with Duncan, I think, about his take on the Amish people. So I think Kunstler agreed with you, Russ,
well,
about
I think
that.
It's what Russ was saying, and I would agree. I do think that the interviewer can be a little bit cut and dry, a little bit laughing a little bit too much at what Kunstler's saying. And
it's got to be hard
it's
for
definitely
Duncan,
not.
Though.
I don't really feel it's like an always a dialogue.
I like Duncan because I think that he does, I think he's smart, and I think he has a lot of good people on his show, and he comes up with good ideas, but it must be difficult. You know, he's interviewed, not for this show, but for other shows, Salman Rushdie. He's interviewed major people from various walks of life. He's reviewed, you know, he's talking with James Howard Kunstler now, and it's a weekly show, and even though it seems like they get along very well, and Kunstler doesn't ever bite his head off, it must be difficult to constantly be talking to these people who are really experts in their field, you know, and if they make a joke, you feel obligated to laugh at it, you know, because, I mean, it's James Howard Kunstler, who's this major guy, or it's Christopher Hitchens, who's this major guy, or it's Alan Dershowitz, who's this major guy, and I imagine that must be difficult sometimes not to kind of fall into this you know,
yeah,
I don't know.
I get the point you're saying.
A little bit overboard, you know, in his reactions. Yeah. So,
were you going to say something, Russ?
Yeah, I mean, given I don't know how fair an assessment this is, since I'm sure if the basis of the show is talking about suburban sprawl, obviously they're going to overlap a lot of these similar issues often. So
yeah.
I don't know that they've never done this before. They probably have. But, I mean, I'm more interested in the discussion as far as constructive solutions to sprawl and how people can deal in their lives in a way to make themselves more efficient or
right.
a way to eliminate waste. And, you know, talking about how the Duncan doesn't have a TV, and he doesn't doesn't like to spend time in front of the computer because he's addicted to these things and feels like it's wasteful, I just don't think is a helpful discussion. I don't think it's an all or nothing thing. I think you have to find degrees of usefulness. And
I mean, I do think it's useful to kind of hear this.
It helps you.
To hear this intelligent man give his philosophy and his enlightenment on what's going on. But I agree with you, it would be nice to hear kind of some pointers. Although I do think, to a certain extent, him showing light on these different issues, or his own light, to have us look at them in a different way, is a step. For instance, we listened to a gentrification episode, and he, right off the bat, said that this isn't necessarily intrinsically a bad thing. I mean, the point of the cities is quite often the rich move in, they take care of the city. They're the ones to be able to take care of the city. What our goal would be to make it so that all different levels within the economy can live within the city, not necessarily to say that it's intrinsically bad to have the wealthy come in and,
right,
and change it.
And I think that, I mean, Kunstler is also known for being controversial. You know, Kunstler is not a knee-jerk, anti-establishment person. You know, Kunstler has been accused of defending parts of the reaction to 9/11, for example, in ways that really surprised people. Kunstler has been very upfront about energy independence and about what that really means. And so, I mean, Kunstler is known for these controversial opinions, but I actually absolutely 100% agree with Russ about this idea that, and with Clea, about this idea of the solutions thing, because that struck me too. One of the things that Duncan says at one point during the show that we listened to a few episodes, Clea and I listened to the gentrification show as well, and one of the things that he mentioned at one point was, there's this show called What White People Like, or this website called What White People Like, and he said one of the things it says white people like to do is talk about not have a TV so they can tell everyone that they don't have a TV. So he said, you know, I know that I'm doing that. But I think that, and he sort of made fun of himself a little bit for that, but I think beyond that, there was a larger issue, which is the problem with a lot of these shows that tend to be very intellectual, very left-wing, tend to have a very sort of contrarian view, Russ, to use your term, of the world at large, is that they do tend to basically just have everyone sit around and muse about how terrible the world is. And I find that's something which is, there's two problems with it. One, it's not particularly helpful. And two, I don't really know then what we're doing. I mean, if all we're doing is sitting around going, do you agree that it's terrible? Yes, it's terrible. Yeah, look at that. Boy, these people, you know, how much good does it do to make fun of people walking down the street with a Bluetooth headset in their mouth, you know, talking to the lunchbox? You can make fun of them till the cows go home, but it's not going to get that person to take the Bluetooth out of her ear. Mm-hmm. How do we constructively work towards getting people to take the next step and not just say, oh my God, we're in the suburbs, but what positive things could we take from this? What negative things could we reject? How would we redo our lives? So I agree, Russ, with Russ entirely about that. Russ's take was my take, actually, that I felt the same way, that it was a little kind of, I don't know, sort of one note. And yeah, I wasn't sure where we were going in that regard.
I agree with that, although I do have to say, your example of the Bluetooth, I think that sometimes the pointing this out to people could possibly create change. I mean, I don't know how else to make a change about the Bluetooth except to point out the behavior to the individual so that maybe they change the behavior. It's okay to have a Bluetooth when you're driving in the car and you need it, but not to wear it at all times.
Although I don't know that making fun of them is going to make them react to this.
Well, no, I understand. Well, okay, yeah, but I mean, think that, I mean, there's also a point where you'd like to kind of make it entertaining, Greg. You know what I mean?
No, I understand. I know.
A lot of people in the mainstream are able to tune out environmentalist types who agree with Kunstler's position, because when they try to listen to environmentalist types, all they hear are these absolute rejections of society at large and saying, like, you and your SUV, you and your oil, you and your meat eating, like, you're all terrible people. And since there's nowhere to go from that and everyone's rejecting each other, then you don't get anything done. And I think that in a way, the discussion in the show sort of fell into that stereotype, which is just like, oh, these people are idiots because they go to the mall and they have their Bluetooths and they're all morons, and I don't have a TV, and the Amish people have some fine points. Like, really? Is that where you want to go with this discussion?
And it's very intelligent stuff, and it's not, it tends to be right, but it's also not, it doesn't go anywhere. It just says, here's the truth, and now what, you know?
Greg and I once watched this episode of Baby Story, it was on TLC, where the father, during the pretty much the entire episode, had the Bluetooth in his ear. And by episode, I mean Baby Story is them having the baby. So throughout the entire delivery of his child, had the Bluetooth in his ear.
Yes, which is, yes.
And one has to wonder.
Hopefully he'll get ear cancer, so it'll be fine.
Great. One can hope.
One can only hope. Such a wonderful blessing that would be.
So what do we want to say for a rating?
But one other thing I wanted to say, too, is that it was also fun to hear them talk about the Amish, because one thing I've always wondered about things like the Amish and Orthodox Jews, Hasidic Jews, was at what point did they decide to make that their outfit? And he made a point of saying the Amish, at what point did they decide we will no longer continue to evolve within our clothing choices?
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting, too, and that's just... I don't see how necessarily that discussion would enhance our society, but I find it interesting kind of discussion about human nature, I guess.
That's true. So what would you guys like to say for a rating? Russ, let's start with you on this one. What do you think for a rating?
Counselor, both guys, very eloquent. Even though I think that the nature of the discussion was a little bit rote and a little bit hackneyed, like it's a discussion that needs to be had, and of all environmental issues, sprawl is the one that's usually least talked
about.
So
yep.
I give it a solid 7 because I definitely appreciated the discussion, even though I had little nitpicky qualms with it.
Yeah, I'd be fine with that.
I would agree with the 7 also. I should point out, there we go with another 7. We've had a lot of 7s lately. I should also point out, by the way, just a few things quickly. There is a transcript on the site of the different shows, which is great, and seems to me must be an incredible amount of work to put together, but in any case, I think that's a very good feature. They also have a forum that they've added, so there are people who actually, you know, write on the forum about different topics in the show, which is a good idea as well. And the audio quality is, as is typical with Duncan shows, excellent. So he's done a good job with that also.
Good ending.
Very interesting, very useful, good show, despite some of the tendency to extremes. But in general, I think we're all in agreement that it's solid.
Yeah, overall, just a quick thing, because we usually talk about the website. The website is pretty straightforward, and they have a forum, a discussion forum, which does seem to be pretty active.
Yep.
So that's cool.
So it's good stuff.
Okay.
So 7 out of 10 for the Consular Cast. Definitely check it out.
Great.
Okay. The next podcast that we have up for discussion is the Volcanicast, a very different kind of show. You can find this at volcanicast.com.
If you've grown weary of the crass fare available from some other podcast media venues, perhaps you should tune in to Volcanicast and be treated to a better class of crass crap.
Playing the Jamie Lynn card.
Pregnant and 14? 16 or whatever.
Number 5 is homophone, and that is people who are afraid of to gay.
So cult fans are douches. Not classy.
Douche
they're douche nozzles?
Douche nozzles.
Douche nozzles. That's a new one on me. I could work with that. Yeah, douche nozzle.
Douche nozzle. It was on Where in the Fifth Grader is Carmen Sandiego?
It affects approximately 1 in every 12,500 women. That's like a 1 in a million.
You realize 1 in a million has a specific meaning, dude.
Volcanicast at volcanicast.com.
This was submitted to us by Wesley from originally Planet Retcon Radio, which we had reviewed a while ago.
Tell me that.
Oh, and I forgot to mention with the other show, both the other show and this show, both of them are not family friendly because both of them involve swear words. The Volcanicast is a lot of swearing and other stuff that would not be suitable for children. But in the Consularcast as well, there are some swear words, but they do say on the transcript and show notes, caution swear words, whereas the Volcanicast just sort of tells you, just in case you're wondering,
podcast.
There will always be swear words. Exactly.
Yeah.
And Wesley admits as much. Again, Wesley is a good guy and had a lot of good things in Planet Retcon Radio that we looked at. But as he describes it, it is a show which is an intelligent guided conversation that occasionally contains swearing and inanity, more than occasionally, by the way.
Yeah.
And it's generally close to 1.5 to 2 hours after editing it down. And basically the whole premise behind the show is that it's a current event podcast done weekly where they look at the newest, most searched items on Google. And so they find the most searched items on Google and then they discuss them in order. And they ask in each case, why now? Like, why is this particular subject being discussed now? And that leads them into a discussion. So the premise, I think, is really interesting.
I have to say, I think that the premise is extremely intelligent and creative and awesome. I think it's the...
Well, we'll talk about the execution in a minute,
But the premise is,
I think, a great idea.
Yeah.
And the website itself, although simple, is easy to navigate. They use PodPress, which is always good as well. And so that's good. And it certainly is very current in terms of its issues.
Yeah. So, I think that the premise is awesome. I just don't necessarily think that they really put it to fruition very well.
Okay. Well, then let's lead off with you, Clea. So what problems do you have? I mean, what issues came up for you in listening to the show?
Well, I questioned how they describe it, that they do this intelligently. They seem to just want to kind of have a beer-guzzling podcast discussion, not something where they're really philosophically or, I would say, intelligently looking at these trends and why this is necessarily happening.
I mean, they say a lot of it's supposed to be comics. I mean, a lot of it is kind of
free-form. Well,
that's
fine, and say that.
But
say it's a free-form, comical take.
It says spans the profane to the profound, so I guess, you know,
okay,
I guess there's a sense about that.
I guess we miss the profound. I just feel that their format doesn't lend itself to that.
That could be. Yeah, there maybe is not as much profound as profane, ultimately, in there. They even have a part of the site that says what we're drinking in terms of what it is, because they always start
out
talking
about the beer. Which is fine. But then just have it be that, and I would almost hope maybe they would have a spinoff where we could actually have an intelligent, profound version of this, because, again, I think the idea is so great.
It's true. I think the comic parts that they want to do tend to overwhelm the serious parts of what they want to do, and maybe that's a problem that can sort of pop in there. And actually, since Clea and Russ and I do the Mep Report show, which is a comedy show, we often have the same discussion, but I don't think we ever go in assuming that we're going to be profound. If it happens by accident, that's fine, but that's not the intention of the show. And I think that maybe these guys are not entirely sure what kind of show they want to run. What's your take on it, Russ?
This show got off on the wrong foot with me very quickly, the specific one that we listened to, because I guess, and I didn't know the premise was talking about Google News stories, which makes more sense, because I thought they launched into a discussion of, well, there is this famous basketball player who is known as Lou Alcindor, and he was really great. You may not know who he was, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, one thing that I can't stand as a sports fan is to listen to civilians try to talk intelligently about sports when it's clear that they have no idea what they're talking about. Right. Like, A, everybody knows who Lou Alcindor is. This is not a surprise. Oh, really? Was that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar?
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Really? Was he one of the greatest?
Milwaukee Bucks, Los Angeles
Lakers.
He's also
this wonderful athlete, a young boxer by the name of Cassius Clay. Perhaps you've heard of him because he floated like a butterfly and he stung like a bee. And imagine, he actually beat all these great fighters. Who's ever heard of, like, come on! I mean, okay. I guess it's just part of the pitfall of having to deal with random news stories every week and trying to speak intelligently about them, and that is certainly challenging. But
for 2 hours every week.
But again, that's my thing. I don't think they were trying to speak intelligently.
But they were. They were trying to explain the skyhook. They're like, he invented a shot called the skyhook, which is kind of where you alley-oop the ball. And I'm like, no, it has nothing to do with alley-ooping the ball. It's a completely different technique than alley-ooping the ball.
Okay.
And you don't even,
do you sense the bitterness
in Russ's
voice?
Properly, so don't talk about it.
Yeah, I had a feeling when I was listening to it that Russ might react poorly to that part of the conversation. I was thinking about
it. And then also, what was the side comment that they made about Obama?
Well, yeah, they made a side comment about that he changed his name. I forget if they said to make it more palatable or less palatable. They said they changed his name, and then they paused and said, not unlike a presidential candidate we know. And I said, well, but he didn't change his name. And I understand there, and I'm sure there are even four, maybe Barack Obama. But the issue is that, and there are three cast members, there are standard cast members. There's Wesley, who's basically kind of the host of the show and organizes the show. There is Bob, and then Sam, who is the female presence on the show. And as they say, her hot New Zealand accent has made her a fan favorite. And I will say that I myself agree that the New Zealand accent is a hot accent. So I can't deny that.
She was my favorite part of the show.
Absolutely.
I know, but again, why does it always have to be the same? You have a bunch of drunk, dorky guys with a woman, and the woman, they always say, oh, she's sexy, and that's why she's here, is because she's sexy. They don't even give her name.
Well,
her name is...
Her name is Sam.
But no, in the cast list, it pretty much describes her as the body. That's what she is.
Well,
that's
a good point. And, you know, that's a good point.
When you have a predominantly male internet audience and you're trying to attract them, what they want to hear is an exotic, beautiful woman surrounded by nerds. This is the world that they picture that they want to be a part of. And that's what you get a lot of the time.
And I think, you know what, actually, that speaking of going to the profound, I don't know how profound it'll be, but that actually makes a good point. I think the issue that we sometimes have with the podcasts that we get sometimes sent to us for review, we had this problem with a show that we did a couple of weeks ago, unfortunately, a couple of months ago now, and it was another one of those shows that was Stuart Bedasso show. And you'll remember, Clea, that our objection to that was it tended to be a lot of just sort of rambling and talking.
Mm-hmm.
The problem I have with that in this case is It's clear to me, because I can tell from the way that Wesley tries to organize the show, that Wesley, and I presume the others, are smart. And as Clea said, the premise is a great premise. So why, it feels to me like it's almost wasting the premise to have it be there and then sort of make it devolve into just this replication of all the other talk podcasts, which is people talking with each other and drinking beer and sort of, you know, talking about random topics. That's not, you know, why replicate that model when you have such a great premise to begin with? And I guess that would be sort of my objection to this, is I think that they've got a great idea and they're able to execute it better than they do. So why then default to, you know, the same old as the other podcasts tend to be? Would be my thought about it, you know. Yeah. I don't know whether it's just because podcasts do that or whether, you know, often do that or whether it's just something else, but I would almost tell them to trust their premise more and trust themselves more and not feel that they have to imitate, you know, these other shows to a degree, would be my sense of it as well.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, the show takes, the other thing is the show, they even have some parts where they have show notes which are extensive. I mean, they have a list of show notes which talk about things about each search term. So they put a lot of work into this, okay? A lot of work. Somebody does. Wesley, if you're doing it, that's a lot of work, man, that you're putting in there. But I think that ultimately what comes out sounding like is another talk podcast. And that's, we've heard those before, you know, would be my take on that. So I guess I would say a 4 or a 5. I would give it a little bit higher because of the premise. I'd be tempted to give it a 5 because I like the premise. And because I, you know, as I say, there's a lot of work going into this. This isn't just literally babbling. I mean, they are trying to, there's this structure. I just don't think the execution works for me. But I would say a 5, I guess.
Yeah, I guess a 5's fine.
While we're talking about people with strange names, I wanted to introduce you guys to a little-known British recording artist known as Jerry Dorsey, who became very famous. You may know him as Engelbert Humperdinck. anyway. I don't think that there's any need for this show to go on for 2 hours. I can't imagine that they... I mean, if they're having fun, that's cool. But
absolutely.
Why would you give yourself an editing task of 2 hours if you're just going to be going... I mean...
I agree with that.
It seems like each of these topics reach the end of their own momentum or volition, like, well within a couple minutes apiece.
Yeah.
Why you have to string so many individual topics together to get to 2 hours doesn't seem to make any sense.
I agree with that.
It's not like the show is about this long, rambling, one-note conversation. It's not. It's about a lot of different things. So break it up, make it easier to digest for the audience. I give it a 4.
Okay, so a 4 for Russ. And the feeling is the show could go somewhere, but our feeling is that it could be executed better. So 4 from Russ, 5 from Clea, 5 for me. So I guess that works out to about a 5 for the show.
Well, I was going to say 4.5. So 4. Can we go more to a 4?
No, we can't do that. We round up.
All right,
the show. So we're going to say a 5 for Volcanicast. Go check it out and see what you think. So the last thing we have, now this is the surprise topic for Russ, is we are going to review a person near and dear to Russ's heart, and that is George Carlin. And you can find more about him at georgecarlin.com, GeorgeCarlin.com.
But it didn't happen. And one of the reasons is because we were using that soft language, that language that takes the life out of life. And it is a function of time. It does keep getting worse. Give you another example. Sometime during my life, toilet paper became bathroom tissue. I wasn't notified of this. No one asked me if I agreed with it. It just happened. Toilet paper became bathroom tissue. Sneakers became running shoes. False teeth became dental appliances. Medicine became medication. Information became directory assistance. The dump became the landfill. Car crashes became automobile accidents. Partly cloudy became partly sunny. Motels became motor lodges. House trailers became mobile homes. Used cars became previously owned transportation. Room service became guest room dining. And constipation became occasional irregularity. When I was a little kid, if I got sick, they wanted me to go to the hospital and see the doctor. Now they want me to go to a health maintenance organization or a wellness center to consult a healthcare delivery professional. Poor people used to live in slums. Now the economically disadvantaged occupy substandard housing in the inner cities. And they're broke. They're broke. They don't have a negative cash flow position. They're broke.
George Carlin passed away this past week, actually.
June 22nd.
He is a comedian who's probably most famous for the seven words you can't say on radio or television. Yeah. But he was a much more sensitive comedian, at least in the beginning, than that. So I think I'm going to let Russ lead off with this, because I know that this is a Russ is a big fan of this guy.
What can I say? I've studied his career very closely, and this was a supremely talented guy who found a national audience just doing impressions at first of famous characters and was making money, and then decided on his own, even though he was already successful, that he wasn't really speaking to his heart. He wasn't reaching the young audience that he connected to personally, and so he scrapped his entire very well-established popular routine and just started touring colleges and campuses and places where more of the counterculture vibe was around, just so that he could speak his mind about things. And he did that for the next 40 years. And unlike other professions, stand-up comedy is special in that you can keep getting better pretty much until you die. And a lot of people would argue that George Carlin just got better every single show over the course of 40 years because he put so much unbelievable work into it, literally toured like 300 days out of the year, never stopped plugging away, and was just ridiculously talented in many different ways. Like, he had full body control, full facial control. He could mimic any sound or accent. In any given routine, you would hear, you know, a dozen different characters coming out of his mouth. Even if he's not talking from the perspective of those characters, they're just sort of popping up in punchlines and talking to each other amidst the routine. Like, it was a virtuoso performance. Even when, like, some of the older stuff from the 70s I don't like as much because it was a little slower moving, but even that was just amazing compared to any modern popular comedian. Not close.
Right.
Not close.
I'd say that's a pretty...
Anyone is performing today.
Yeah, I'd say that's a pretty strong endorsement. We should mention, by the way, that Carlin, in case you've been living under a rock and don't know about him, Carlin is not ever safe for any kind of work or family ever. Carlin is decidedly not about that. He's very much an adult's comic. The thing that I always felt about Carlin, and I, you know, I'm going to be interested to see what Clea thinks about this too, and Russ, my feeling was that I thought that Carlin was at his best before he became, I mean, because he looked, we saw him a couple of years ago, and he really looked awful. I mean, he looked like he was kind of really fading fast. And, you know, part of that is he had, you know, he did drugs, he drank, he smoked, and
well, and
he
as
did
Russ
a lot
said,
of
he
stuff.
Lived a hard life.
He lived really a hard life. And I think he was really beaten down by the world in a lot of ways. And I always felt that Carlin, as he got farther on his life, became, and this is, again, not based on anything from anyone else, just in my opinion, I felt that he became very bitter. And that bitterness came through in his comedy to the extent where I often felt then that listening to a routine, I was like, you know, George, I think you're better than that. You know, rather than just making jokes about, you know, the first names of the people who got us into the Iraq War and making sort of lewd jokes about that, I always felt that he could be better than that, and he was better than that. When he was at his best, he was weaving together this kind of comic narrative, which was both funny and sad and humorous and moving, and it was precisely because he didn't talk down to his audience. I mean, the whole seven famous words you can't say on radio and television was largely a meditation on language. You know, he was talking about, why do we find these words to be the big problems? Why are these words worse than these other words? And that kind of thing I always thought was brilliant, brilliant stuff, and I guess I wish that there had been a little bit more of that from him in his later life, because I think people just knew him as kind of the guy who swore a lot, and that's not that he was much more than that, I think, and I think he sort of contributed to that, was my take on sort of the later part. But Russ, you can feel free to say that I'm wrong. I mean, that was just my sort of feeling on how he was.
I agree with almost everything that you said, Greg. He is one of my favorite comedians all time, but he doesn't get past all criticism of mine. I happen to, as we've discussed before, I happen to like darker material a little bit more than you do, so I don't really mind his, like, half-hour meditations on suicide and, like, trying to create a television network where everyone kills themselves, because that's the obvious evolution of modern public media in this country. Those were some, I think some of his darkest stuff was just a more biting critique of the system, a system that he saw was inevitably going to break down and had no hope of rescue. Now, this is sort of what happens when people get older. They lose that sort of, gleam of hope that they can fix things, and they just resign to the fact that they live in a world that they don't approve of. And I think the same thing happened to Carlin, and that's why his material went in that direction.
Interesting.
Yeah, I can agree with that.
So, Clea, what was your, what did you think about Carlin's career as you understood it? I mean, we actually just got back from seeing Eddie Izzard, who we reviewed previously. We saw a show of his last week, and we thought he was good. And I know that you like Eddie Izzard a lot. What was your view of Carlin overall as a comedian and as a performer? What was your take on?
I would agree with everything that you guys have said, and just add, just kind of as a social worker, I mean, I think one of the reasons he was what he was so good at doing impressions, so good at being poignant, was because he was a sensitive soul. And I think those people, as they age, are delicate. You know, it can be really hard to see things just getting worse and to lose hope. And I think that it's hard when things seem to be going so wrong and things people doing such stupid things. It's hard to not just want to just rant and lose your eloquence. Mm-hmm. And so I think that might have happened. But definitely I think the breadth of what he did do makes up for anything.
I mean, the fact that comedian after comedian after comedian, not just Russ, who obviously we respect not only as a friend, but as an excellent comedian, and Clea, who obviously is not just my wife, but is also an excellent comedian, the fact that all of these people that I respect, both professional and amateur, who have been in the field of comedy, all tell me that this guy was to some degree, moderate, major influence. They all mention Carlin as being an influence upon them in one way or the other, I think speaks volumes about what the guy actually did. I mean, there are a lot of comics today that are very forgettable, and you see a million of them, and they just vanish out of your memory, and you can't ever imagine people not using the example of George Carlin as one of the people that sort of showed the way for comedy, leaving aside the things I said about the over-reliance on language later in his career and the bitterness and all that stuff. That's my take. It doesn't change the fact that his influence was so significant, and, you know, maybe there's something to be said for a guy who throws napalm, you know, where everyone is just sort of tiptoeing around like they're walking through a field of butterflies. Maybe there's something to be said for a guy who says, no, here's the problem with society, like we were talking about with the Kunstler cast, and here's why I think it's so funny, and you need to wake up and smell the coffee, like Clea was saying about that show. Maybe that applies to Carlin too, so maybe there's something to be said for that also. So I'll let Russ finish with the rating, so I'll start with myself on this one, and then Clea, and I'll finish with Russ here. I would give Carlin, I think, an 8. I think the influence that he had was so significant, despite the bitterness stuff and all that, there's just no calculating how important he was in terms of the overall feel for comedy, and he was a smart, smart guy that I think will be missed by the comic community and outside of it, so I would say an 8. Clea?
Oh, I think I want to do more of a 9. I mean, I think it's tough. I mean, for newer comics to be so influential, because, you know, in anything, artists still be influential. You know, it's the earlier you get in the game, the easier it is, I think. But I don't want to lose the fact that, you know, for the last 40 years, he's been pretty influential, whether in the limelight or not. Actually, didn't we listen to an episode of something where they talked about George Carlin, and they were talking about some of the recent movies that he was in? And
right.
Even
in
the small... I think he's included in these small little cameos because of what he can bring, even with a small little character. He doesn't even have to say anything. Just his presence as that character does something to the character in how it's portrayed. So
right.
I guess I'd say a 9.
Okay, Russ?
One other thing about Carlin that, if you don't follow him closely, you may not know, is that he's one of the last, maybe, truly anti-commercial popular figures. So, like, he would get up on stage only because he himself had built up a following over years and nobody could stop him from performing, and talk about the big media conglomerates in the country and the corporations and the lack of a true democracy because our system is run by money. Nobody else in the public eye can say things like that. I can't think of two other people that can just publicly call all of that into question, the money influences that we have in our society, which pervade everything. And because of that, you know, he wasn't as commercially successful as he could have been. He didn't get on network TV very often. He wasn't
right there
advertising and making commercials because
did a lot of HBO
the corporations
stuff,
didn't like him and he didn't like them. Yeah, exactly, because HBO is the independent force where you don't have to have advertising back you up to be a big-time guy.
Right,
and
right.
I respect him so much for that. To be able to do that and just say, you know, give the finger to all of these hugely powerful forces and be able to criticize them, I think was amazing. For anyone who likes and is familiar with George Carlin's political comedy specifically, I'd also like to recommend one of my other favorites, Bill Hicks, who was a young comic in the 1990s who died tragically.
Yeah.
And a lot of
And people also have
actually picked up by Carlin late in Carlin's career.
Yeah, there's also a big thing about Hicks, about some people, some of his material being stolen, and Hicks didn't really care. It wasn't important to him. I think he had his particular...
Oh, yeah, I mean, I've seen that. Like, being a student of both of them, like, I've seen two of Bill Hicks's mainstay routines just basically lifted by Carlin. And I think that's okay, honestly, because Bill Hicks died, and you need, you know, someone to carry the torch, and who better than the master?
I forgot he was on a children's
and, you know,
show, too.
Maybe
he was the conductor on a children's show. I forgot that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that train show. Anyway, I love George Carlin. I liked his linguistic stuff less than his political commentary, but overall, one of the funniest, most prolific comedians that you could ever imagine. I give him a 9.
All right, so we have a 9, a 9, and an 8, and by my property previously demonstrated in the past show, that the past review, it means that we give him a 9. So a 9 to George Carlin. Rest in peace. He will be missed. That's going to do it for us for this week. We want to thank everybody for listening. And Russ, we want to thank you for being a part of the show again. We hope that the surprise was worth it. And
thanks for having
that
me.
That it was a good review topic for you.
Yeah, I love old George.
Good old George.
Hey.
And
what tubes? Where these tubes?
Where these tubes? And we want to thank everybody for listening as always. And we will check you guys out next week. Upon further review, I'm Greg.
I'm Clea.
I'm Russell.
See ya.
The proceeding was a presentation of Upon Further Review, hosted at www.furtherreview.net. As usual, all rights are reserved. If you liked what you heard, please vote for us at podcastalley.com, vitalpodcast.com, and add us to your list of favorites at podcastpickle.com. You can leave us a comment at www.furtherreview.net, drop us a line at upon@furtherreview.net, or give us a phone call or send a fax to 206-339-UFR1. That's 206-339-8371. And lastly, don't be afraid to express your opinions. We know you have them. Let them out. Feel the power. Or you could just blindly accept whatever we tell you is fact. That'll work.
Bravo!
I loved that.
Oh, it was great.
Well, it was pretty good.
Well, it wasn't bad.
Well, there were parts of it that weren't very good, though.
It could have been a lot better.
I didn't really like it.
It was pretty terrible.
It was bad.
It was awful.
It was terrible.
Get him away!
Hey, boo!
Boo!